अहमद शाह दा पोतरा ना जिस शाह जमान खैबर लंघिया नाल ने भूए होए अफगान किसे ना अगों रोकिया लथा आ लाहौर वेखे ऊपर समय ने सारे वटे तौर अगे भी ओ आया कर हले त्रैवार पर सिंघा ने उस दी दित्ती भुगत सवार सिंह लपक दे रात नू कणिया चलना वड पेंदे पुत्र काल दे सहसर जांदे वड सूरज अस्तन सार सी सिंह पैन ललकार चपट ले जांदे सैकड़े घोड़े ते हथियार वैरी नू वंगार के टकरन बन के काल चमके तेग पंजाब दी लख है बिज समाल सिखर दुपहरे गजया पंज दरिया दा मान सम्मण बुरज हेठां खलो ललकारिया बलवान अहमद शाह दे पोतरे नितर विच मदान हुनर विखा कोई तेग दा जेतू है अफगान चढ़त सिंह दा पोतरा तैनू रहया मंग आ दसा सिंह किस तरह करदे है ने जंग Ahmad Shah's own grandson, Shah Zaman was his name, through the heights of Khaybar with unruly Afghans came, marched ahead unchallenged, for Lahore he made, but this time was different, doomed was his crusade. It was not his first time there, three times he had fought, this time the Sikhs were ready, a lesson he was taught. At dead of night they would attack, bravery insane, verily the sons of death, to behead them fain. Every time the sun had set, challenges they spewed, arms and armaments were seized, horses were subdued, challenging their enemies, the six angels of doom. Like bolts of lightning shining swords, all Punjab illume. Midday sun high in the sky, a mighty roar is heard. At the foot of Samman Burj, the hero's ire stirred. O grandson of Ahmad Shah, dare to take the field. If you are a true Afghan, your scimitar you will wield. This grandson of Charat Singh, he challenges your might. On this day from him you learn how a Singh does fight.
Welcome to the sixth episode of The Rise and Fall of the Sikh Empire. I'm your host, Sunur Kaur. In this episode, the King of Afghanistan, Shah Zaman, invades the Punjab for the fourth time. This time, determined to destroy the backbone of Sikh power. Awed by his fury, the Sikhs prepare to retreat, but Sadat Kaur seizes the moment and convinces them to oppose the invader. Ranjit Singh, who is appointed the commander of the combined Sikh forces, has a memorable encounter with the Afghan king at the Lahore fort. Further to the east, George Thomas attacks the Sis Sutlej Sikhs, provoking a robust response from Rani Sahib Kaur, the sister of Raja Sahib Singh of Patiala, and wife of Jaimal Singh Kanhaiya.
After the dramatic rescue of Begum Samru following the mutiny of the Sardana Brigade, George Thomas had been sent on a campaign to subdue the rebellious Rajputs by his Maratha masters. The command of the Maratha Sepoy Brigades had been turned over to General Piran after the retirement of the legendary General Benoît de Boigne. Very different from his former leader, who was suave, polished, and incorruptible, Péron hated the British with an intensity that was matched by George Thomas's disdain for the French. Hence, Thomas had returned to the territories controlled by his master, Appa Kande Rao, north and west of Delhi. Appa Kande Rao, who George Thomas had served with valor and distinction, had become increasingly fond of the Irishman and had started to treat him like an adopted son. George Thomas had been engaged in a campaign against the Sikh commander of Shamli when he received word that Appa Kande Rao was grievously ill and had decided to travel to the holy Ganga where he would end his life. The Maratha chief, in a letter, asked his foster son to rush to his side so that he could say goodbye. By the time he arrived at Kannauj, he learned that Appa Kande Rao, unable to make the longer pilgrimage to the Ganga, had drowned himself in the Yamuna. The death of his mentor was a huge blow to George Thomas, for his nephew Vaman Rao refused to confirm the territories that had been given to the Irishmen. As Thomas was readying to confront Vaman Rao, Péron sent a large detachment of sepoys under the commander Dudernach to his defense, who dispossessed Thomas of all of his territories except Jhajjar, leaving him without the means to support his large army. Reduced to banditry to sustain himself and his men, Thomas decided to turn his attention to the tract of land northwest of Jhajjar that was a buffer between his territory and that controlled by the Sea Sutluj Sikh chiefs. The land, known as Haryana, had once been fertile, but by that time had become barren, with little water for agriculture, and was hence not claimed by any king or chief. George Thomas managed to capture the town of Hansi, which he made his capital. He made extensive repairs to the ancient fort of Hansi and managed to grow his force considerably. He also captured the town of Hisar, as well as Kanauri, from where he recruited more than 200 fierce fighters as irregulars. He carved out an oval swath of territory, bordered in the north by the Ghaggar River, beyond which lay the territories of Raja Sahib Singh of Patiala. In the west, by lands controlled by the Bhatti tribe, and in the south, by Rewari, which was under Maratha control. Between the lands that he controlled directly and those that he held for the Marathas, George Thomas now ruled a kingdom that yielded an annual revenue of 400,000 rupees. Already renowned as a brave warrior and an excellent military commander, George Thomas also acquired the reputation of a very capable and benign ruler. Bolstered by his successes, he started eyeing the rich lands controlled by the Sea Sutluj chiefs. As George Thomas was busy establishing his rule around Hisar and Hansi, the situation at the Maratha court was deteriorating even further. The experienced and crafty Nana Fadnis had been temporarily sidelined, and Daulat Rao Sindhia had emerged as the most important power at the court of the Peshwa in Pune. Daulat Rao's closest advisor, Sharza Rao Ghatge, who had offered his beautiful daughter Baiza Bai in marriage to Daulat Rao, was a secret supporter of Nana Fadnis, who was Daulat Rao's arch enemy. Baji Rao II, who had been declared Peshwa after the death of the previous incumbent Madhav Rao, had been deposed and replaced by his younger brother Chimanaji Appa. Sharza Rao now contrived to depose Chimnaji Appa and restore Baji Rao II to the throne, following which Nana Fadnis returned triumphantly to Pune to become the chief minister of the Maratha Empire again. While the new Peshwa lived a life of decadence and indolence, the empire suffered, with the chief warlord Daulat Rao in dire straits for a lack of funds. In the year 1797, Tukoji Holkar of Indore, the great rival of the Sindhias of Gwalior and Ujjain, passed away, precipitating a new crisis that had disastrous consequences for the Marathas. Per his dying wishes, his oldest son, Kashi Rao, who was physically handicapped, was declared his successor, prompting his younger brother, the brash Malhar Rao, to revolt. Kashi Rao Holkar sought the support of Daulat Rao Sindhia, who gleefully agreed to get involved, sending a detachment of soldiers that attacked and killed Malhar Rao Holkar. Tukoji's fourth son, the very brave Jaswant Rao, was wounded and forced to flee, seeking refuge with the Raja of Nagpur, who had been a dear friend of his late father's. Daulat Rao's position was thus strengthened even further, but he continued to suffer from a lack of funds at a time when revenue collections in the north were down significantly. He moved against Nana Fadnis with the Peshwa's support and arrested him in an attempt to seek his fortune to pay his soldiers, who had not been paid for a while. Madhaji Sindhia's widows, who were universally respected, had already been at odds with Daulat Rao, as he had been withholding the funds that had been promised for their maintenance, and they decided to march upon him with their armies. In response, Sharza Rao tried to effect a coup and preemptively arrested several of their supporters in Pune as they approached from the north. When he had the widows physically assaulted as he tried to arrest them, Sharza Rao caused a civil war to break out in Pune. Nana Fadnis, viewed as the only statesman who could bring about a compromise, was hastily freed from prison, but the civil war dragged on. In the north, the two principal Maratha generals, Jaggu Bapu and Lakhwa Dada, joined the cause of the widows. Arrayed against them were Ambaji Ingle, the veteran Sindhia general who had been appointed Daulat Rao's representative in the north, and General Perron, who commanded De Boyne's brigade. Towards the end of 1798, as the two factions strained against each other, trying to capture and hold Ujjain, news of yet another imminent Afghan invasion started to filter in. In May 1798, a new Governor-General arrived in Calcutta to oversee British interests in India. Richard Cawley Wellesley had been born in 1760, 4 years after the birth of Sardar Maha Singh Shukrachakya, to Garrett Wellesley, Earl of Mornington, a member of the Irish aristocracy. Educated at Harrow, Eton, and Oxford, the budding Latin scholar left college without a degree on the death of his father in 1781 to become the next Earl of Mornington. A member of the Irish House of Lords, he also served in the British House of Commons multiple times. He also served as junior Lord of the Treasury and various other administrative offices in the British government. After Sir John Shore retired as Governor General of India in March 1798, the post was to go to Lord Hobart, the Governor General of Madras, but in order to placate the officers of the Bengal army, who hated Hobart, the directors of the East India Company offered the position to Lord Cornwallis and the governorship of Madras to Wellesley. However, when Cornwallis learned that the directors of the East India Company had been in touch with the mutinous officers of the Bengal army, he resigned, paving the way for Wellesley to be appointed the new Governor-General. He was received by Sir Alured Clark, 16 years his senior, who had been serving as the acting Governor-General after the retirement of Sir John Shore. Clark, a seasoned officer in the British Army, who had seen action in the American Revolutionary War, had already served as Governor of Jamaica and the Lieutenant Governor of Lower Canada. He had subsequently been promoted to Lieutenant General and was given command of the Bengal Army after being sent to Fort William in Calcutta, which was the British headquarters in India. Clark spent a long time with the newly appointed Governor General, bringing him up to speed on the political situation in India and the challenges that he would have to face. The very first conversation on territory was conducted before a map of India. The three major centers of British power in India at the time of Wellesley's arrival were the presidency cities of Calcutta, Bombay, and Madras, and the territories around them. The three presidencies were separated by large distances, and the only way to travel between them without passing through, quote, foreign territory was by sea. The Bengal presidency, centered in Calcutta, was the largest, consisting of the provinces of Bengal, Bihar, Orissa, and Chittagong, which the British ruled through the Diwani, or right to collect and administer revenues, granted by the Mughal Emperor Shah Alam. The British also had control of the cities of Banaras and Ghazipur, as well as the fort of Allahabad. The Bombay Presidency, governed by Jonathan Duncan, was small and consisted of the islands of Bombay and Salsette. The Madras Presidency included villages surrounding the city of Madras, in addition to three districts seized from Tipu Sultan of Mysore. It also included a 200-mile stretch along the Malabar coast. The British also controlled five districts along the Bay of Bengal, known as the Northern Sarkars, which they had wrested in tribute from the Nizam of Hyderabad. They had treaties with Arcot and Tanjore, which allowed them to take over their administration during times of war. After he had acquainted the Governor-General with the territories he was responsible for administering, Sir Alured Clark was asked to educate his superior about the other powers in India. He first talked about the enormous kingdom of Awadh, northwest of the Bengal Presidency, which was firmly under the control of the British resident, with the Nawab Saadat Ali Khan II reduced to being a mere figurehead. Clark responded with disdain to Wellesley's questions about the Mughal Emperor Shah Alam, dismissing him as a virtual prisoner in the hands of Daulat Rao Sindhia, who exercised control over the Mughal crown lands largely through General Perron. When asked about the Rajputs, Clark said that constantly at odds with their Maratha overlord Sindhia, they would be willing to ally with anyone who helped them gain a measure of independence. The Marathas, as Clark explained to Wellesley, were still the most powerful force on the Indian subcontinent, organized as a pentarchy that controlled a large swath of territory in central India. The Peshwa at Pune, the Sindhias of Ujjain and Gwalior, the Holkars of Indore, the Bhosles of Berar and Nagpur, and the Gaikwars of Baroda. The continued absence of Daulat Rao Sindhia, unequivocally the most powerful Maratha chief from the north, was a big issue for the British, as they would most likely have to deal with any threats to Delhi. The one Maratha chief that Wellesley was told the British needed to watch closely was the mercurial Jaswantrao Holkar. As he prepared to take over the reins of the British administration, Wellesley took note of the other powers that he would have to deal with as well. The Carnatic Sultanate, ruled by the Nawab of Arcot, was practically under the control of the British. The Nizam of Hyderabad, Asif Jah II, had been a faithful ally of the British, but he had been severely disappointed when the previous Governor-General Sir John Shore had not aided him in his war against the Marathas in 1795. The biggest threat was Tipu Sultan of Mysore, who was constantly plotting against the British as he tried to regain the territories he had been forced to cede to them. When asked about the Sikhs who controlled the Punjab, Clark professed ignorance, suggesting that while known as a warlike people, they were for the most part disunited brigands who were much feared in the Mughal crownlands as well as Awadh and Rohilkhand because of the predatory raids that they had been launching for decades. Clark also advised the Governor-General about the ever-present threat from Afghanistan. As the young King Shah Zaman seemed determined to regain his territories in Punjab and re-establish Afghan domination over Delhi in the manner of his legendary grandfather Ahmad Shah Durrani, the Sikhs, according to Clark, would not be powerful enough to check Shah Zaman's invasion, which seemed imminent. While protecting British territory in India was of paramount importance, there were other pressing concerns for the new Governor-General. During his predecessor's time, the revenues of the East India Company in India had shrunk, its debts had grown, and its access to credit had diminished. After he had been brought up to speed on the challenges that he faced, Wellesley came to an important conclusion that would inform his administration of British territories in India for the next 7 years. He would be foolish to continue the somewhat timid policy of non-interference in the affairs of Indian states, which John Shore had followed, for it was clear to him that British interests in India had stagnated, warranting a more aggressive and expansionist approach. The challenges were significant, but Wellesley would go on to prove that he was more than equal to the task. By the middle of 1798, Ghulam Muhammad Khan, Shah Zaman's envoy, arrived in Lucknow, bearing expensive gifts and a letter for Nawab Saadat Ali Khan II. The letter, which was read in the Awadh court, clearly expressed Shah Zaman's intentions. The Afghan king wrote that he was about to embark on a, quote, hunting expedition to Hindustan to strengthen the government of the House of Taimur, to which he professed kinship and friendship. He chided the Nawab of Awadh, whose father had been the Grand Vizier of the Mughal Empire, for allowing the Marathas to take possession of Delhi. He wrote that he expected the support of the Nawab and his British allies in the service of the Emperor Shah Alam when he launched his campaign to destroy the power of the Marathas and the Sikhs, who were the main culprits responsible for the decline in the Mughal Emperor's fortunes. Ghulam Muhammad Khan also carried a letter addressed to John Shore, which was delivered to the new Governor-General Lord Wellesley, which similarly referred to his imminent expedition. Shah Zaman wrote of his desire to, quote, ascertain who are our friends and who are our enemies. The Governor-General, who had already been alerted to the presence of senior French commanders in the forces of Daulat Rao Sindhia, Asif Jah II of Hyderabad and Tipu Sultan, bitterly opposed to British expansion in India, was alarmed by the letter. There was even a possibility that Napoleon might form an alliance with Shah Zaman, Daulat Rao Sindhia and Tipu Sultan to throw the British out of India and send an army through the overland route from Afghanistan. Ghulam Muhammad Khan also brought a letter for the King of Nepal, and another envoy, Mir Abdul Khan, visited Daulat Rao Sindhia's court to deliver a letter for Colonel Palmer, the British resident there. While his agents were engaged in diplomacy in India, Shah Zaman started making preparations for the invasion. He turned to Rahmatullah Khan, his brother Shuja-ul-Mulk's brother-in-law, and made him his principal advisor with the title Wafadar Khan. A crafty man with polished and courtly manners, Wafadar Khan, who hailed from the king's own Sadozai clan, became the principal courtier in charge of the Indian expedition, superseding the vizier Sher Muhammad Khan, whose father had served as vizier to Shah Zaman's illustrious grandfather, Ahmad Shah Durrani. The king clothed himself in red and sent out proclamations calling for warriors to join the impending campaign. Excited by the prospect of a lucrative Indian campaign, soldiers started pouring into Kabul. Soon, Shah Zaman had an army of 60,000 horsemen, with 2,000 camel-mounted jamburaks, 35 large guns, and an enormous horde of irregulars and camp followers. Shah Zaman left Kabul with his army in early September and arrived at Peshawar, where he received tribute from the local chiefs and held a war council. Some of his advisors suggested that in order to avoid the Sikhs, the army march through Multan, Bahawalpur, and Bikaner. There was some merit in the suggestion, as Raja Pratap Singh of Jaipur and Raja Bhim Singh of Jodhpur, with armies of 14,000 and 16,000 each, might have joined hands with him against the Marathas. However, considering the long trek through the desert to be too risky, the king ordered that three bridges of boats be constructed across the Indus at Attock. When news of the imminent invasion reached the Marathas, a force 100,000 strong with 200 pieces of artillery was assembled at Hodal to check the Afghan advance. General Piran ordered that a brigade of sepoys from Aligarh also be sent in support. Lord Wellesley put several defensive measures in place as well, sending envoys to the Emirs of Sindh in order to win them over, and another one to Daulat Rao Sindhia to get a defensive treaty in place. He instructed John Lumsden, resident at Lucknow, to sound out the Si-Sutlej Sikh chiefs to gauge their intentions in the event of Shah Zaman being able to pass through the Punjab. But distrustful of them, he asked the resident to stop short of signing a formal treaty. He also ordered a large British force to Anupshahr and demanded that the Nawab of Awadh join it as well, with 5 of his best battalions and 50 guns. The British were ready for Shah Zaman. On October 19th, an Afghan advance guard under the command of the son of the late Ahmad Khan Shahanchi Bashi crossed the bridge of boats at Attock and marched upon Sarai Kali, the westernmost outpost of the Sikhs, commanded by the wife of Milkha Singh of Rawalpindi. The lady evacuated the fort and retreated, leaving 2 subordinate chiefs in charge, who were overwhelmed by the Afghans and sent to Attock, where they were brought to Shah Zaman's presence. The Afghan king accepted their offer of a ransom of 3,000 rupees and then had them drowned in the Indus. Shah Zaman advanced to Hasan Abdal, and by mid-November he had reached the fortress of Rohtas, which had been abandoned by the Sikhs. Shah Zaman's camp was roiled by the animosity between his 2 principal advisors, Wafadar Khan and Sher Muhammad Khan, the former alleging that the latter had sent secret messages to the Sikhs, informing them of the Afghan army's movements, which of course he denied hotly. A chagrined Shah Zaman vowed to investigate the matter as he commanded his forces to continue their advance. The Sikh chiefs retreated before the advancing army in disarray. Gujarat, abandoned by Sahib Singh Pangi, and Gujranwala by Ranjit Singh, were both attacked and plundered. Many of the Sikh chiefs sent their families and their hoarded treasure to the hills to protect them from the Afghans. As his advance guard approached Dinanagar, Shah Zaman sent messages to Raja Sansar Chand of Kangra and Raja Jeet Singh of Jammu, warning them against providing shelter to fleeing Sikhs who had entered their territories. In mid-November, the Muslim chiefs of Shahadra invited Nizamuddin Khan of Kasur to take charge of the forts that had been evacuated by the Sikh chiefs. Ranjit Singh and Sahib Singh Pangi, at the head of a cavalry contingent of 500, fell upon Nizamuddin Khan, attacking him with great ferocity. Nizamuddin Khan was shot in the leg but was spirited away to safety, and the Sikhs were scattered by the forces of Ahmed Khan, Shahanchibashi's son. The next day, Wafadar Khan was attacked between Gujarat and Wazirabad by the Sikhs, who imposed heavy casualties upon him, but were forced to retreat. Despite the skirmishes, in which Sikhs gave a good account of themselves, they seemed to be no match for the huge invading force, and it appeared that Shah Zaman's dreams of retaking Punjab were finally on the cusp of coming true. While Shah Zaman was advancing through the Punjab, 200 miles to the southeast of Lahore across the Sutlej, George Thomas, the Raja of Hansi, was presented with an enticing opportunity. Hasan Khan, a feudatory of Raja Bhag Singh of Jind, presented himself at George Thomas's capital asking for his help. Raja Bhag Singh had conferred the village of Kaushan as a jagir upon him, but it had been seized by Khushal Singh, an ally of Bhag Singh's. Hasan Khan had petitioned the Raja of Jind for relief, but when his pleas fell on deaf ears, he decided to turn to George Thomas. Always ready to be hired for any potentially profitable venture, Thomas agreed to intervene in return for a sum of 7,000 rupees. Thomas had always had his eyes on the Sikh territories, much richer than his own, and after successfully restoring Kaushan to Hasan Khan, he attacked Jind. Raja Bhag Singh fought back and inflicted heavy casualties on Thomas, but despite losing 400 men, he laid siege to Jind. A rattled Bhag Singh appealed to his fellow Sutlej Sikh chiefs for help, in particular Raja Sahib Singh of Patiala, his kinsman. Sahib Singh was eagerly awaiting the arrival of Shah Zaman, given his earlier offer of support, for the Afghan king had kept him apprised of his plans to invade India. Sahib Singh had sent two envoys to Peshawar, reiterating his support for Shah Zaman, and when they had arrived with letters from the Afghan king and his wazir, Sahib Singh had reverently placed them on his forehead in his court before commanding that they be read. Hoping to profit from Shah Zaman's expedition, he was most reluctant to go to Raja Bhag Singh's aid. His sister, Sahib Kaur, who served as the Diwan of Patiala, was made of sterner stuff, and she remonstrated with Sahib Singh, saying that it was their duty to help Bhag Singh beat George Thomas back. Surely, she said to her brother, if they allowed Jind to be overrun, Patiala would be next. She asked Raja Sahib Singh for 10,000 rupees to fund the campaign against Thomas, but he flatly refused, prompting her to send an urgent message to her husband, Sardar Jamal Singh Kanhaiya, who was at his headquarters at Fatehgarh. When Jamal Singh sent her 12,000 rupees, she went to her brother to get his approval for the campaign, which she could now fund without burdening the Patiala treasury. Sahib Singh responded angrily, saying that this was not the time to go adventuring in Jind because of the uncertainty and opportunity that Shah Zaman's invasion presented for Patiala. Defying her brother and declaring that Bhag Singh's house was their own house, she gathered an army and marched to Jind's relief. She was joined by Sardar Baghel Singh and other chiefs who were as determined as her to send George Thomas back to Hansi. The first engagement was a disaster for the Sikhs, for as soon as they arrived in the vicinity of Jind, George Thomas unleashed a furious artillery barrage and scattered their forces. Thomas's men pursued the Sikhs all the way back to their camp, plundered it, and then burned it to the ground. The Trans-Satluj Sikhs were looking at a potential debacle as the Afghan juggernaut advanced through their territories, closing in on the capital, Lahore. Ranjit Singh and Milkha Singh rode into Amritsar, where they conferred with Sardar Gulab Singh Pangi, Sardar Bhag Singh Ahluwalia, Sardar Jamal Singh Kanaiya, and Sardarni Sada Kaur. They sent messengers to Sardar Jassa Singh Ramgadiya, Sardar Tara Singh Gabba, Sardar Rai Singh, and Sardar Bhanga Singh, asking them to join hands with them to repel the Afghans. They also contacted Sardar Sahib Singh Bedi, who had been planning to retire to the hills. A Sarbat Khalsa was called at the Akal Takht in Amritsar. The Sikh chiefs assembled at the Akal Takht and the debate began. Conspicuously absent was Raja Sahib Singh of Patiala, who had been invited but had declined, declaring that any anti-Afghan enterprise was doomed to fail. Most of the more experienced Sikh chiefs were of the opinion that it was time to abandon Amritsar and go into hiding again. There was no way they could take Shah Zaman's enormous army head-on, and their best bet was to resort to the traditional hit-and-run tactics that had so frustrated the Afghan king's grandfather during his expeditions to Punjab. The Sarbat Khalsa was about to issue a Gurmata, which would have instructed the community to flee to safety, when Sardarni Sada Kaur stood up to speak. She made an impassioned plea for resistance and declared that it was time to end the depredations of the Afghans, who had been the scourge of Punjab for decades. When most of the chiefs demurred, she mocked them, asking them to put on women's clothes, for she was determined to gird up for battle and would personally lead her troops against the Afghans. Her son-in-law, Ranjit Singh, she declared, would fight by her side. Ranjit Singh got up to speak as well and begged his fellow chiefs not to abandon the Sri Harmandir Sahib, which had been desecrated so many times by the Afghans. His great-uncle, Sardar Dal Singh, got up to speak as well, declaring that the myth of Afghan invincibility was just that. He had just pulled off an audacious raid, attacking a caravan on its way to Lahore from Kabul, laden with fruits and nuts for Shah Zaman and his court. He had ambushed the caravan close to Gujranwala, and in addition to the provisions, he had captured 70 camels, 20 mules, and many other valuable items. Sardarni Sada Kaur's pluck and her fiery rhetoric carried the day, and the Sikhs decided to fight. The dissensions in Shah Zaman's camp escalated even further, and during a heated disagreement on strategy, Wafadar Khan had the temerity to slap the vizier, Sher Muhammad Khan, in the king's presence. The vizier seemingly bore the insult with fortitude but vowed revenge, determined to humble the proud Wafadar Khan. He sent secret messages to Ranjit Singh and the other Sikh chiefs, encouraging them to continue their campaign of harassment against the Afghans, suggesting that it might frustrate them enough to make them return to Peshawar. As Shah Zaman got closer to Lahore, he started sending out raiding parties in multiple directions to check the flight of the Sikhs. There were several skirmishes as the Afghans encountered Sikhs who were returning from the hills after escorting their families to safety. A detachment was sent to Jammu to secure the submission of Raja Jeet Singh, who paid tribute and assured the Afghans that he and his family had never assisted the Sikhs against the Afghans and never would. When Shah Zaman got word of Sikhs massing in Amritsar, he sent a detachment of 10,000 troops to march on the city. Ranjit Singh and Saif Singh Bhangi were patrolling the area at the head of 500 horsemen when they sighted an Afghans. A fierce battle ensued, which was joined by Gulab Singh and Jodh Singh with 2,000 horse. Both sides suffered heavy losses, and the Afghans were forced to retreat. Shah Zaman had started to run into financial difficulties, finding it hard to supply his large force, which prompted him to reach out to his allies for funds and additional men. Muzaffar Khan of Multan begged to be excused as the harvest in his territory had been destroyed by floods. The Sial chiefs of Jhang also expressed their inability to support the effort. The king turned to his two senior-most advisors and got conflicting counsel. Sher Muhammad Khan felt that it was inadvisable to press on given the perilous financial condition of the campaign. Further, he said, the Sikhs had taken their families to safety and were determined to resist, which was bound to make progress through their lands extremely difficult. He had also received intelligence that the Marathas and the British had formed a defensive alliance and were lying in wait with huge armies ready to engage the Afghans should they be able to navigate their way across the Punjab. Finally, he told Shah Zaman that his brother Mahmud would most likely use his absence from Kabul to launch yet another rebellion in Herat. Wafadar Khan, on the other hand, provided a much more optimistic assessment, insisting that the Sikhs and the Marathas were no match for the might of Shah Zaman's army. He acknowledged that the British were a formidable power, but he was confident that their might would be offset by the Rajput kings, who were bitterly opposed to the Marathas, as well as several Muslim rulers who would surely come to his aid once he reached Delhi. Frustrated by the meager returns from the campaign until then, Shah Zaman was more inclined to listen to Sher Muhammad Khan's advice, who suggested that he confine his goals to taking the Punjab, which he could do most effectively by conciliating the Sikh chiefs, who were the real masters of the province and were likely to submit to him if the right terms were offered to them. At the end of November, Shah Zaman entered Lahore, promising to punish his soldiers harshly if any of them dared to molest the city's residents. The principal chiefs of Lahore and Nizamuddin Khan of Qasur all attended a grand darbar at the Lahore fort in Shah Zaman's honor, and the city was illuminated with lamps to welcome him. As the Afghan king was holding court in Lahore, the Sikhs were massing around Amritsar, readying to take him on. Realizing that the best way of putting pressure on the Afghans was to cut off their supply lines and prevent grain and fodder from reaching Lahore, the Sikhs tried to put a blockade in place. Ranjit Singh, at the head of 11,000 men, camped on the road between Amritsar and Lahore and sent another detachment to isolate Qasur from Lahore as well. The price of grain shot up in the Afghan camp and supplies started to dwindle rapidly. On the evening of December 4, Shah Zaman rode on an elephant through the streets of Lahore that had been illuminated by the bankers and the traders of the city to curry favor with him. Some unexpected visitors greeted him at one of the city gates after nightfall, and they were escorted to his presence. Jodh Singh of Wazirabad, Nidhan Singh of Shekhupura, and Wazir Singh Naqai had arrived to pay their respects to the Afghan king. All of them were invested with robes of honor, and in return for their submission, their territories were confirmed by the king, who asked them to encourage other Sikh chiefs to follow suit. Ram Dayal Kohatia, Ranjit Singh's agent, Ratan Chand Ved, Sahib Singh Pangi's agent, and Diwan Mokam Chand, representing Dal Singh of Akalgarh, who were also present, were similarly honored. In parallel with their attempts at diplomacy, the Sikh chiefs continued to belligerently attack Kasur and the surrounding territories, prompting Shah Zaman to send Nizamuddin Khan back to his capital with a contingent of Afghan troops to beat back the besiegers. Shah Zaman, deciding that he needed to step up diplomatic efforts, commanded Wafadar Khan to send an envoy to the Sikh chiefs. The matter had become particularly urgent because his troops had started to get restive. Their greatest motivation in joining his expedition was plunder, but the campaign had yielded nothing. Shah Zaman's directive that the citizens of Lahore were to be left alone, and his vow to severely punish any soldiers who plundered the city, had brought his men to the verge of mutiny. The first Afghan envoy, Diwan Atmaram, arrived in Amritsar, bearing expensive gifts from the Afghan king, but while a few Sikh chiefs were willing to talk to him, most of them rebuffed their efforts and forced the ones that were wavering to swear a new oath of fidelity to the Sikh panth or nation. Skirmishes continued at Aminabad and other places as frustration grew in Lahore. The British Governor-General received intelligence that Shah Zaman, whose efforts to conquer or win over the Sikhs were faltering, was likely to return soon. Wafadar Khan sent a second agent, Nikki Singh, to Amritsar, who at first seemed to make a little more progress than his predecessor. He presented Ranjit Singh with two pairs of shawls and three turbans, and Sardar Tara Singh Gabba with a pair of shawls as well. Both Ranjit Singh and Sahib Singh Pangi conferred robes of honor upon him and sent two warriors, Ghasi Singh and Mohan Singh, to escort him back to Lahore. An offer to return the booty captured from the Afghans was made to Shah Zaman through Nikki Singh, and Ranjit Singh also told him privately that if he was named the commander of Lahore Fort, he would offer 100,000 rupees in tribute. It finally looked like Shah Zaman was making progress in his attempts to conciliate the Sikh chiefs. Sardar Dal Singh himself rode out with Nikki Singh and accompanied him for several miles. The agents of the Sikh chiefs were greeted with respect and given presents. The goodwill, however, was not destined to last very long. The very next day, a detachment of Naqai horsemen was set upon at Chunia by an Afghan raiding party led by Nizamuddin Khan, and the Sikhs were scattered. Two Sikh commanders who fell into Afghan hands were roughed up and their hair was cut off to humiliate them. Ranjit Singh was livid and, gathering 1,000 horsemen, decided to march upon Lahore. Jath Singh and Sahib Singh Pangi also mustered an additional 2,000 men to join the expedition, but the greybeard Sardar Dal Singh intervened. Ranjit Singh and Sahib Singh Pangi's envoys were still at Lahore, and it would be both indecorous and foolish to retaliate before their safe return. Sahib Singh and Chet Singh were persuaded to stand down, but the tempestuous young Shukarchakya chief would not be restrained. He fearlessly rode right up to the walls of Lahore Fort with a small band of his swiftest horsemen. The little band came to a halt at the foot of the Samam Burj, or tower, where Shah Zaman had his quarters. "O grandson of Ahmad Shah," he thundered, "if you are a man and a true Afghan, leave the walls of the fort. The grandson of Charat Singh Shukarchakia wants to engage you in single combat." There was no response from the fort. Even though Shah Zaman's invasion of India was faltering, the British Governor General was not leaving anything to chance. The French contingent in India in the armies of the various states was formidable, and there was no way to predict the outcome if Shah Zaman proceeded through Punjab and threatened the British or their allies. Mirza Mehdi Ali Khan was a Persian who had lived in Banaras for several years and then in Bombay under the patronage of the governor of the Bombay Presidency, Jonathan Duncan. The British East India Company had established a trading post on the Persian coast at the city of Bushehr. When Shah Zaman's intentions had become clear in the fall, Mehdi Ali had been dispatched to Bushehr as a British envoy upon Wellesley's command. His mission was to induce Shah Fateh Ali Khan of Persia to attack Khorasan in order to divert Shah Zaman's attention away from India. Mehdi Ali's mission was highly successful, for on his inducement, which came with a British offer of arms and ammunition, the Shah of Persia decided to march upon Khorasan. On January 3, 1799, Shah Zaman received news of the Persian attack on his western frontier, his brother Mahmud, constantly conspiring to win back the throne of Kabul, had raised the banner of revolt again. The king ordered his camp to be moved to Shahadra and commanded his ministers to prepare the army to return to Kabul. His allies, Bhambu Khan Rohilla and Nawab Nizamuddin Khan, were dismissed, and an audience was granted to the representatives of the Sikh chiefs who had travelled to Lahore to pay their respects to the king before his return. As he started his march homewards, Shah Zaman chartered them with protecting his rear, and they escorted him up to the Jhelum. As soon as Shah Zaman had left, Jait Singh returned to occupy Lahore. Milkha Singh hurried to Rawalpindi, and their fellow chiefs immediately started re-establishing their control over the territories that they had abandoned. Shah Zaman suffered terrible luck as he retreated. Torrential downpours began as he was crossing the Jhelum, and several of his heavy guns, which were on the dry bed of the river, were lost in a flash flood. The roads were in terrible condition, and the Afghans were constantly harried by tribesmen, anxious to relieve them of the meager plunder that they had collected. The Sikhs were seeking an opportunity to harass him as well when he was crossing the Chenab, but Ranjit Singh dissuaded them from attacking and he was allowed to leave unmolested. At Gujranwala, Ranjit Singh's attendants resupplied the Afghans at their chief's command. Shah Zaman arrived in Peshawar on January 30, 1799. From Peshawar, Shah Zaman sent Ranjit Singh a missive asking him to recover the 12 guns that had been swept away in the waters of the Jhelum. He needed them for military operations on his western frontier, and in exchange he offered Ranjit Singh Lahore and indicated that he would wait in Peshawar for the guns before leaving for Kabul. In early March, Ranjit Singh was able to get 8 of the guns dragged out of the Jhelum, which he promptly dispatched to Peshawar. Much pleased, Shah Zaman responded with robes of honor that were sent to Ranjit Singh, along with a declaration permitting him to take Lahore. Shah Zaman's permission was not particularly meaningful, as Lahore was firmly in the hands of the Bhangi triumvirate again, who would have disdained any claims made in the Afghan king's name. However, Ranjit Singh, who had already studied the defenses of Lahore and understood the city's importance, started actively thinking about capturing the city. As Shah Zaman was retreating from Lahore, Rani Sahib Kaur's attempts to relieve Jind continued to falter. But then she had a stroke of good fortune. Raja Jaswant Singh of Nabha, Sardar Bhanga Singh of Thanesar, and other Sea Sutlej chiefs arrived at Jind to support her efforts. With 9,000 Sikh horsemen at her command, she attacked George Thomas fiercely and killed several of his men, putting the Hansi forces on the defensive. George Thomas tried to keep the siege going, but a steady stream of desertions and several reverses in the field forced him to raise it. Rani Sahib Kaur took control of the defense of Jind and sent a detachment after George Thomas, who was camped at Narnaul, midway between Jind and Hansi. The Sikhs were routed and fled back to Jind, where they were berated for their cowardice by Rani Sahib Kaur. The wily George Thomas, who understood the divisions between the Sikh chiefs, bribed one of them, Karam Singh of Sahibabad, to stay out of the fight, and the Nabha forces seemed reluctant to engage as well. After George Thomas won another victory, he sent his Diwan Uday Singh to negotiate terms. Rani Sahib Kaur, disgusted by the treachery of her fellow Sikh chiefs and lacking confidence in the men under her command, welcomed Uday Singh to Jind. She was seriously considering George Thomas's offer, which essentially was for all the chiefs to recognize the territorial boundaries that existed before his attack on Jind, when her brother Raja Sahib Singh arrived. Rather than commending her for her spirited defense of Jind, Sahib Singh, overcome by jealousy at his sister's successes, refused to sign the agreement with George Thomas. The other Sikh chiefs were eager to accept the agreement, however, and end hostilities, and a frustrated Sahib Kaur defied her brother and signed it in her capacity as the Diwan of Patiala. Raja Sahib Singh's wife, Us Kaur, and several of the courtiers, also jealous of Sahib Kaur's highly visible role in the administration of Patiala, poisoned the king's mind further and prompted him to dismiss her and throw her in jail. At her wit's end, Rani Sahib Kaur urgently sent word to her former foe George Thomas, who, highly impressed by the Rani's bravery during their conflict, immediately marched upon Patiala to rescue her. After skirmishes with several Sikh chiefs at Bhador, Kakhnaur, and Sunam, George Thomas started getting closer to Patiala. The terrified Sahib Singh immediately released his sister from prison and agreed to pay for all the war expenses that George Thomas had incurred. The vindictive Sahib Singh would not let his sister live in peace. After George Thomas had retreated, he imprisoned her again. Rani Sahib Kaur managed to escape to Sangrur, but she was confined again at the fort in Bhavanigarh, where she passed away at the young age of 26, most likely as a result of foul play. The great-granddaughter of Sardar Ala Singh, the founder of the Patiala kingdom, was endowed with the courage and foresight that he had been famous for. She had served Patiala faithfully during her short life and would be remembered as one of the greatest leaders of the kingdom, unlike her brother, the king, who was much reviled for his petty and self-serving nature. After the threat from Shah Zaman had receded, Lakhwa Dada, aided by Jaggu Bapu, joined the Sindhia widows in the war against Daulat Rao Sindhia, starting a campaign in the Malwa region and plundering their former master's territories. The war spilled over into Mewar, which was held for the Marathas by Ambaji Ingle. Daulat Rao Sindhya sent word to the commanders of Agra, Delhi, and Aligarh to turn over the forts to Peron, but being supporters of Lakhwa Dada, they refused, forcing De Boyne's storied brigades to lay siege to the three forts. Since the bogged-down Peron could not come to his aid, Ambaji Ingle hired George Thomas to defend Mewar, paying him the princely sum of 50,000 rupees a month. Daulat Rao also sent the commanders Bala Rao and Bapu Sindhya to bolster Ambaji Ingle's forces. Lakhwa Dada's nimble cavalry brigade prevailed in several skirmishes, forcing Daulat Rao to consider his tactics. Other threats were on the horizon as well. Lord Wellesley, having abandoned the policies of non-intervention that his predecessor had subscribed to, was clearly an expansionist, and after capturing the Nizam of Hyderabad, had delivered a stinging defeat to Tipu Sultan of Mysore. A few months earlier, Jaswantrao Holkar had crowned himself the king of Indore. The Holkars and the Sindhias had been the greatest Maratha houses and equals, but during the reign of Madhaji Sindhya, the Sindhias had pulled far ahead in terms of wealth, power, and prestige. The fortunes of the Holkars had been on the decline during the last years of Tukoji Holkar, but now his valiant and audacious son had seized power and commanded a force of 8,000 horse and 15,000 foot. Inevitably, Lakhwa Dada solicited Jaswantrao Holkar's help and induced him to attack Daulat Rao's capital, Ujjain. Holkar defeated the weak Sindhya garrison at Ujjain and extracted tribute from the city, but was persuaded by Lakhwa Dada to retreat. Burdened by the debts that he had to take on to fund the ongoing civil war, and realizing that an alliance between Lakhwa Dada and Holkar was a threat that could not be ignored, Daulat Rao Sindhya turned to diplomacy. He ordered the release of the minister Baloba Tatya, Lakhwa Dada's mentor, and reinstated him, paving the way for Lakhwa Dada to return to his fold. A formal settlement was made between Lakhwa Dada and General Peron, under which the Maratha general was once again declared Daulat Rao's supreme commander in the north. Two of Peron's crack battalions were placed under Lakhwa Dada's command, and the Frenchman was given command of Delhi, Agra, and Aligarh. Ambaji Ingle, who had returned to command Gwalior, was forced to give up Mewar and surrender all the territories that he had captured from the widows, and he decided to dismiss George Thomas, who returned to Hansi. As the year 1799 was coming to a close, some measure of tranquility seemed to have returned to the territories in the north that the Marathas governed in the name of the Emperor Shah Alam. The respite, however, was not destined to last, for new powers were rising both to the east and the west of the Marathas.
Rise and Fall of the Sikh Empire is brought to you by Almas Media, the creators of the Story of the Sikhs podcast and the Gurmat Sangeet podcast. The podcast features original music by Indian classical guitar maestro Ritom Sarkar. Tabla accompaniment is provided by Swarnava Ghosh. The podcast is made possible by the Chardi Kala Foundation, Ishpreet Singh, and Manpreet Kaur and the Sawhney Family Foundation. It is written and narrated by Sarbjeet Singh, author of The Camel Merchant of Philadelphia, The Night of the Restless Spirits, The Story of the Six, and Kultar's Mine. In the next episode, Ranjit Singh, with the help of his mother-in-law, Sada Kaur, takes Lahore, the capital of Punjab. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Sunar Kaur.